Hello, this is David Sedaris. I'm a writer and have been making these BBC Radio 4 shows for a few years now. Mostly they're recorded with the studio audience, but what with everything, we decided to record them from my home this time. The actual stories and diary entries were recorded in the little room above my office, but the producer thought it would be nice to introduce the show each week from a different room in my house. Welcome to my kitchen. I'm trying to speak quickly, as any moment the stove will start roaring. That's what it does, this big hulking thing. I turn it off, but I don't know how. Anything having to do with cooking, that's Hugh's doing.
There it goes.
Every now and then, I really don't have that much to say. I mean, I can wrap it up in 4 or 5 pages. So today we'd like to present a number of short essays. Don't think about sex robots. Just as I was certain that every aspect of the coronavirus had been addressed, I found an article on how it was adversely affecting prostitutes. They can't exactly file for unemployment benefits, so many have apparently started GoFundMe campaigns. Good to know, I said to Hugh, who was across the table from me, frowning into the newspaper. When I mentioned the article to my agent, she said, I don't see why they can't just Skype, not that it will really fix anything. It's just a matter of time before sex robots drive all those people out of business. Who are you, I wondered. I mean, sex robots? This is my agent. A lot of people are moving their business online, though. I have a friend with a fair amount of disposable income. She has a trainer, a Pilates instructor, and a regular acupuncturist, all of whom suggested they continue their sessions via FaceTime. I said the first two make sense, but how would that work with the acupuncturist? Are you supposed to stick the needles in yourself? He said we'd start by looking at my tongue and then talk about my general wellness for $400 an hour, she told me. I'd like to keep people in business, but this just makes me feel used. A week ago, the managers of my New York apartment building decreed that no more construction work could be done. Someone had complained that their neighbors were having their kitchen remodeled. There was a fear that the workers might bring in coronavirus, so it was all shut down. Now they've decided that personal assistants and housekeepers are out as well. I'm in the sort of building where a notice like this packs a real punch. 60 units, and Hugh and I have to be the only ones who clean our own floors. I've already volunteered to run errands for people. Should one of my elderly neighbors need something from the supermarket or drugstore, I'd be happy to wander out and fetch it. I'm not a dog person, but I offered to help in that regard as well. Then I amended it and said I'd be willing to walk any dog that has a colostomy bag. I mean, really, I have to draw the line somewhere. There are those who say that the best thing I can do for my neighbors is to stay indoors. But I can only take so much, and it's not like I'm getting that close to anyone. When two people approach one another on the sidewalk now, each of them hugs the far edge, like enemies. Our eyes don't even meet anymore. I'm getting so desperate for face-to-face contact, I often go down just to talk to the doormen. They wear masks now, so their speech is muffled. Together we'll look out at the street, at the traffic that isn't there, and at the pedestrians who no longer walk by. Well, okay then, I say after 10 or so minutes. I guess I'll go see what Hugh is up to. Then I touch the elevator button with my elbow and head upstairs, trying hard not to think about sex robots and how much one might possibly cost. I was asked a few years back by a television show in the United States to write a little essay about anything that was bothering me or on my mind, and this is what I came up with. Haven't we met? I'm the sort of author who travels a lot, 100 or so cities a year. I read out loud, and then I sign books for 3, 4, 5 hours a night, so I meet a lot of people. Most of them I forget, but every so often someone will stick. Maybe it's their name or their size. With one guy, it's a thumbtack tattooed on his forehead. We've met before, I say. It makes people feel good to be remembered. I know it pleases me when the shoe is on the other foot. David, my boyfriend of 30 years might say, and I'll just float for the rest of the day. I like to make people feel good, so often while signing books, I'll look up asking, haven't we met? I get a lot of repeat business, so half the time the person on the other side of the signing table will say, wow, you have a good memory. It was last fall in Boston. Of course, I'm wrong just as often as I'm right. A young Korean-American woman came through the line a few years ago. We've met before, haven't we? I asked. And she said, right, because all us Asians look alike. If I could do it all over again, I'd say, wait, aren't you Akira Kurosawa? Or you were in those Margaret Cho comedy specials and that Amy Tan movie you starred in and wrote because you're somehow Ming-Na Wen and Amy Tan. I am actually very capable of distinguishing one Asian person from another, except for my friends Matt and John Ewan, who are identical twins and have matching haircuts and eyeglasses and weigh the same. They dress alike, live together, and honestly don't care if anyone can tell them apart, so I'm not going to feel bad about them. The young woman at the book signing, though, give me a break. Similarly, I was recently with a friend of mine who was a bit fragile. We were on a dark terrace, looking at the stars, when a young woman approached to say she liked my books. How nice of you to tell me that, I said. She was a college student and reminded me that I'd once met her sister, who had since gone back to India to visit their grandparents. My friend, who was standing awkwardly beside me, then entered the conversation, saying, I think I waited on you once at the UPS store I work at. The young woman's voice turned stony. No, she said. I'm afraid that was some other brown person. Or some other rude person, I thought, cringing on behalf of my friend. Because not everything is a microaggression. Sometimes people make mistakes. And the big thing to do, especially when they're obviously fragile, is to say, I get drunk and do a lot of blackout shipping, so maybe that was me. Or something, just to get through it. My boyfriend and I live here in England, and whenever we walk into an antique store together, the owner will ask, without fail, are you two dealers? No, I say, just homosexuals. They must think just like I did when I was chided by the young Asian American woman, and my friend had her head taken off on the dark terrace. Jesus, can a person say anything anymore? So I've made up my mind to retire my snide little just homosexuals response and say instead, I can't believe you don't know who I am. Got 3 to 4 minutes? Here's an essay. It's really short. On hoarding. It used to be that nobody ever called me. I get notices on my phone reading, last week you had 1 minute and 12 seconds of screen time. Now, though, with the pandemic, I'm Mr. Popular. The first person I usually hear from is my sister Lisa, who will start with an update from her local Costco in Winston-Salem. They announced a new delivery of toilet paper, but it was gone by the time Bob and I got there. In New York, my sister Amy came for dinner and showed me a Rolling Stone photo essay on shoppers hoarding at superstores. Because everything sold in such great quantities, the carts look miniature. Gun sales have gone up as well, Hugh said. Amy put her phone away, so people can protect their toilet paper? Our friend Christina was at the table, too, and we told her how bad we are at hoarding. You have to understand, I grew up shopping with my father, Amy said, with a professional. I remember him during the oil crisis of 1973, heading to the Shell station with empty cans and getting in line at 4 a.m. All our cars had a full tank, but he needed the next guy's ration as well. I didn't even drive, but still he taught me how to siphon. I remember the shock of a mouthful of gasoline, spitting it out onto the street and thinking, someone could have used that. Can you imagine Dad 20 years younger? I said to Amy. He'd be out there every day, buying pallets of fruit cocktail. And toilet paper, he'd have a forest's worth under a tarp in the backyard. If rats chewed holes in the plastic and it got rained on, he'd stick it in the oven or go at it with a hairdryer. How can we, his children, be so bad at the kind of shopping he prided himself on? I tried to hoard at Whole Foods the other day and came away with 2 steaks and a pouch of dried coconut. Coconut, Hugh said when I got home. What am I going to do with that? That night at Morton Williams, I tried again and returned home with a package of ballpark hot dogs, a pint of buttermilk, and some taco shells. I give up, Hugh said. Oh, but I haven't. Amy and I went to Italy the next day, determined. Twice we were scolded by staff members for standing too close to the person ahead of us at the butcher and at the freshly made pasta counter. We have the floor taped so you know what distance you should keep, said the woman who did the scolding. It helps to look at which shelves are bare. That teaches you, I suppose, what you should be hoarding. Most of the people I see in lines these days aren't real cooks. I noticed at my neighborhood stores that all the canned spaghetti sauces were gone, the horrible ones that taste like ketchup, as well as frozen pizzas and burritos, stuff we never eat. Toilet paper is gone too, of course, as are paper towels. I've started watching YouTube videos by a conspiracy theory influencer, a QAnon guy who sees a correlation between epidemics and election years and suggests that we connect the dots. When Trump said we are fighting a hidden enemy, the influencer knew that he was talking about the deep state cabal and not the coronavirus. Where do people get this stuff? I said to Hugh. Then I blew my nose into a scrap of fabric I've been carrying around. Good luck finding Kleenex anymore. Tissues and napkins are the new alternatives to toilet paper. A drugstore in my neighborhood had hand sanitizer the other day. There was a sign in the window announcing it, and a number of people looking at the sign and waiting for someone to open the door. That happens a lot now. No one wants to touch the handle. Fine, I always say, I'll do it. Then you have to stand there and let 30 people through. The drugstore had big bottles of hand sanitizer, but I couldn't see the little ones, and I couldn't bring myself to ask because I didn't want to look like I was panicked. I guess that's what makes for a successful crisis shopper. Like my dad standing in the dark with his empty gas cans, these people don't care what they look like. It doesn't matter if they get glared at. Hidden as they are behind an 8-foot tower of toilet paper, they're never going to register it anyway. That's the spirit, I can imagine my father saying, as they unload their carts in the parking lot, filling every cubic centimeter of their massive SUVs. A quick stop home to drop off the frozen stuff, then it's back to the store for 30 gallons of bleach. It seems that I know a lot of people who will believe absolutely anything. So I thought I would write an essay about them. Crystal ball. I was with some house guests not long ago, sitting around a table, when one of them mentioned a crystal ball she had been thinking about buying. Just to have, she said. Then I talked to a bunch of people and learned that it would suck all the energy out of whichever room it was in, which makes sense, I guess. No, it doesn't, I said. Everyone looked at me. Not just the woman who'd been talking, but our other 2 friends as well. Crystal balls aren't real, I said. I mean, they don't actually do anything. But they're crystal, one of the 2 men said. So of course they have special powers. None of the 3 were what I'd call New Agey, so their reverence for crystals surprised me. Just as it had surprised me years earlier to hear them talking ghosts and of how they can get into your house by way of antiques or second-hand clothing, like from Goodwill or whatever, even if the coat or sweater in question had been dry-cleaned. They were all on board for horoscopes as well, and spent small fortunes having their charts done. Psychics they believed in as well, along with those places where you get yourself hooked up to an IV of saline solution just for the heck of it. I'm pretty sure a glass of water will do the same thing, I said, marveling for the umpteenth time over this growing obsession with hydration. If you were found wandering the desert, disoriented, fine, but after a 3-hour flight during which you emptied 6 bottles of Evian, I really don't know how necessary it is. Another friend of mine is treating her cancer with mistletoe enemas. I said, excuse me, what? The only problem is it is not covered by my medical insurance, she said. How can that possibly be the only problem, I thought. How can this be anything but the mistletoe industry sitting around the day after Christmas and thinking, huh, what else could we use this for? Another friend recently told me of a race of 10-foot-tall people who possessed superhuman strength and pretty much ruled North America for a good long while. That's fascinating, I said. Where are their skeletons? Government's got them, I was told. This is the same person who filled me in on the gigantic underground machine the U.S. government built to control the weather. Climate change, he explained, is completely fabricated, a way to tear us apart. All of these people are professionals. They make decent livings and pay taxes. And though they don't often come out and say it, I can sense them judging me for being so small-minded, for not at least allowing the possibility that a crystal ball on a shelf in the living room might wear me out, or at least make it a bit harder to concentrate. I try to see myself opening up, expanding my mind the way they want me to, but then it all goes foggy. Jazz hands. The village Hugh and I live outside of in Sussex wants to be more green, and so they invited an environmental activist named Claudia to give a talk about climate change. I was out at the time, picking up trash along the side of the road, but saw the speaker a few hours afterwards when she dropped by the house. How was it? I asked. Interesting, Hugh told me. It was my first experience with jazz hands. I said, jazz hands? Claudia then explained that applause can interfere with the flow of a presentation and that this was a way of silently showing support. If you agree with something, you flutter high like this. She made the motion you might if you were waving goodbye to two babies at the same time. And if you disapprove, you go lower. It's brilliant, she said. The jazz hands weren't the point of her talk, but I couldn't get beyond them. I said to Hugh afterwards, it's not just that I don't like the idea, I'm actively threatened by it. I'd felt the same way a few years back when my friend Steve attended a conference in Manchester. Certain members of the audience were made anxious by the sound of applause, so the organizers insisted that everyone use jazz hands, which they said were more inclusive. He just mentioned it in passing, but I felt as if he'd put a knife to my throat. As someone who spends a good part of his life on stage, I don't want a sea of waving hands. I want applause, and I want them to be deafening, preferably accompanied by whoops. Floor stomping is fine, too. And whistling. Sustained, please. What about people who have no hands, I asked. How is this inclusive for them? What about the blind? How are they supposed to know their remarks are appreciated if they can't see the audience doing jazz hands? I was reaching, but isn't that what you do when you're threatened? And who is truly made that anxious by the sound of applause, I asked. There can't be more than a few of such people, can there? Isn't there a point where if you're the one person in 1,000 who's bothered by something, you should just stay home? I'm actually more threatened by jazz hands than I am by climate change. When it comes to that, I'm probably like most people. This is to say that I judge others for their carbon footprint while finding reasons to forgive my own. When people give me a hard time about, for example, the amount of flying that I do, I say that, well, I don't have children. Didn't I read somewhere that that's the worst thing you can do for the planet? Procreate? Of course, it's cold comfort to those who had kids before climate change was a thing. And of course, the fewer people there are, the fewer there are to applaud. For me. Took days to write this, but it doesn't take very long to read it. Give me 3 minutes and I'll give you an essay. Getting there. I have a pretty nice home. Several, as a matter of fact. That said, I love not being in them. As a rule, I travel between 90 and 140 days a year, even more when I can squeeze in a vacation. When the coronavirus shut everything down, it wasn't the big, exciting cities I missed going to on my book and lecture tours, but rather the small ones. When I was young, I'd see comedians on chat shows plugging their upcoming engagements. I'll be in Moline, March 23rd, then in Appleton, Wisconsin, and Salina, Kansas. What a loser, I'd think, running my fingers through the fringe of my velveteen vest. What I didn't know at the time was that anyone can fill a theater in New York or Los Angeles. To sell out a show in Odessa, Texas, though, that was something. It's not being in those third-tier markets that I miss so much as getting there. Often, such cities are too small to have their own airports, so traveling from one engagement to the next tends to involve two planes and sometimes a lengthy car ride. This means a driver. I know people who climb into the back seat with headphones on. It's their way of saying, "Don't speak to me." Others have it written into their contracts. Mr. Important is absolutely not to be disturbed. Me, I'm astounded by what they're missing. In California once, I was driven by a woman whose cousin had both his arms chewed off by wild pigs. He was a baby, she said, by way of explanation. Now he's a hotshot lawyer who sews buttons on his shirts using his feet, which proves you can do anything once you set your mind to it. A year later in Florida, I had a female driver who owned a 4-foot-long corn snake named Nigel. And in Oregon, not long afterwards, I was met at the airport by a man who identified himself as Middle Eastern. He didn't specify a country, so I didn't push. We got to talking, and I learned that he had a daughter who was 10 years old and had just won the reading contest at her local library. "For the second year in a row," the man said proudly. "We have many books in our house and candles." I was just feeling enormously sorry for him and his family, that poor child ruining her eyes before a flickering flame, when I realized he'd said Kindles, not candles. Another driver who comes to mind took me from my hotel to the airport one morning and asked what I do for a living. "I write," I told him. "Well, don't you ever give up," he said. "No matter what nobody tells you, don't you ever quit." "Okay," I said. "I mean it," he told me. "This is your dream, so if you want to make it happen, you got to work on it." "I'll keep that in mind." "Maybe you can find a girl who likes to read," he continued, his voice so full of hope and encouragement. "Maybe you could let her look over what you're writing and give you comments." He looked at me in the rearview mirror. "Hey, you never know." I think of these people, their industry all but destroyed by the coronavirus, and count the days until I can be in their back seats again. Me, delighted, and them likely wondering, is this guy ever going to shut up? Skirt. I was on a plane a few months back, sitting across the aisle from a man with silver hair. When we landed, he opened his overhead bin, pulled out my tote bag, and handed it to the woman beside him, saying, "Here you are, miss." "That's mine," I told him, surprised as the bag had never struck me as particularly feminine. I mean, it has cowboys on it, for God's sake. "I'm terribly sorry," the man said, so embarrassed I wanted to add, "That's okay, I used to be a woman," or something, just to set him at ease. This is happening to me more and more often lately. "Here's your wife's ironing," I'll be told in a hotel. "Wife," I'll think, reaching for my pink gingham shirt with the rickrack down the front, or one of my 9 pairs of culottes. Like my tote bag, I never considered these items to be ladylike. I said to Hugh they'd probably think my caftan belongs to my wife as well. I have no desire to be a woman or to do drag. Never have I longed to wear makeup or panties. True, I have breasts, but I never wanted them. Did nothing to bring them on other than get old and start eating a little too much. Sometimes, though, when I see a skirt, I'll think, why not? I don't mean a short one or anything tight. I'm talking floor length, almost like the bottom half of a ball gown, the kind you'd have to lift with both hands when you come upon a puddle. Who decided that's women's wear? Who gets to make those decisions? Of course, things aren't as dire as they used to be. Designers do make skirts for men. You see them in fashion shows, worn by resentful male models, their hands formed into fists, but rarely on the streets. The thing is that while I want to dress like Scarlett O'Hara from the waist down, I don't want to be stared at. Rather, I want long skirts on men to be normal. No more remarkable than the cargo shorts and promotional t-shirts I see guys my age wearing pretty much everywhere I go in America. Sneakers, backward baseball caps, they dress like overgrown boys and no one thinks a thing about it. That's what I want, but without the cap and sneakers. Replace a t-shirt with something more presentable, and instead of cargo shorts, give me something voluminous and ankle length that will make a slight rustling sound as I round the corner to the men's room and take my rightful place at the urinal. This is something I think about when I think about acting. Golden Heart. I'm not sure how I come down in the recent debates surrounding representation about, for example, Scarlett Johansson playing a trans person in a movie. On the one hand, a young actress has the right to portray whomever she wants. It's part of the job description to inhabit a wide range of available characters, be it a blonde whore with a heart of gold to a brunette or even a red-headed whore with a heart of gold. On the other hand, there are real trans actors out there who must be thinking, then what role can I get? A while back, a young director made a movie based on an essay I had written. One of the characters was a middle-aged double amputee I'd worked for years ago in the Pacific Northwest. I thought of someone arriving in a wheelchair for the audition, his pants empty from the knees down, thinking, I have got this. And it made me feel good. Then they cast an actor who was fully able and erased his legs with a computer. That might be okay if the same worked in reverse, but to my knowledge, no one has ever cast someone with amputated limbs saying, no problem, we'll stick them on in post-production. A friend is writing a television series and offered to create a part for me. That's okay, I told him, I'm not an actor. Emotion-wise, I'm okay, maybe, but I never know what to do with my hands. Not a problem, he said. I'll make you someone who was born without arms. I'd be lying to say I didn't think, Then I thought of the actor who truly has no arms and figured he'd likely feel the way I do when, yet again, a straight guy plays a gay man in a movie, always so bravely. Oh, how he's congratulated. When asked on talk shows about the love scenes with his male co-star, he always admits that, ha ha, it wasn't easy. It would be for an actual gay man, I say to the TV. I mean, honestly, the casting directors couldn't find a gay actor? Have they never eaten in a New York City restaurant? Most of us cannot not find a gay actor. Once you start down this road, though, where does it end? Should only Catholics be allowed to play Catholics? Only Americans, Americans? And what about actual whores with hearts of gold? Don't we deserve our screen time, too? Thank you for listening to the show. Everything today was written and read by me, David Sedaris. The producer is Steve Doherty, and it was a Giddy Goat production for BBC Radio 4.